Hi, I'm Xian Qi, Executive Director of Byron Writers Festival, and you're listening to our Mind Spa podcast series recorded live at the Byron Writers Festival 2023. This session, titled Living Recklessly, is a conversation of travel and adventure between Mireille Day and Susan Johnson.
Before we start, I'd like to make acknowledgement of country. Held today on the lands of the Arawak, Bimbabin and Minjungulbal peoples of the Bundjalung Nation, we pay respect to the traditional owners of these lands and acknowledge them as the original storytellers of this region. Obviously, I'm not Matt Condon, so I apologise to everybody who's here who's a fan of Matt's. Unfortunately, he's had a family emergency and couldn't do this session today. So I'm a last-minute stand-in. My name is Susan Johnson, but very thankfully, I'm also a huge Mireille fan. So I was very, very pleased and honoured to be asked to do this session today. I've been a fan of Mireille since Lambs of God, so I'm sure many of you will know that book. We will talk about Lambs of God and Mireille's other work today, but first we're here really to talk about her wonderful new memoir, Reckless. And for those of you who haven't read it, do rush out and buy it, and there'll be a signing afterwards so you can buy it then. Just to give you a bit of background, Mireille grew up in Sydney and graduated from Sydney University with a BA Honours. She's worked as a fruit picker, an academic, and I believe she's also mentored, I've just learnt, several people in the audience here. She's been a long-time mentor of emerging writers here at Byron Bay, and she's a very active member of the community here, the literary community. She's worked in many jobs, but she's also travelled widely, and she's lived variously in Italy, France and Ireland, where in her beautiful prose she has described as she breathed in the heady aroma of the place I have always wanted to be, elsewhere. Mireille's acclaimed books are many. The Life and Crimes of Harry Lavender was in 1988, and it was her first thriller, followed by The Case of Chinese Boxes in 1990, The Last Tango of Dolores Delgado in 1992, which won the 1993 Seamus Crime Fiction Award, and The Disappearances of Maddalena Grimaldi in 1994. In 1996, Mireille was the general editor and contributor of How to Write Crime, and I believe she's done a lot of workshops on this over the years as well. But in 1997, many of you, like me, will probably first came to her work when she published the hugely acclaimed literary novel Lambs of God. And it was published here in Australia and also overseas. And in 2019, it appeared as a four-part series screening on Fox's Showtel, and it starred Essie Davis. And we will talk about that later too. But I think that what Mireille has is a unique capacity in Australia's literary landscape in being able to be both literary and popular. You know, the Claudia Valentine series, which are the crimes, is the female detective featuring in many of these, the books I just mentioned, has won the Ned Kelly Lifetime Achievement Award for crime writing, which essentially means she writes books but sells them. Many people in Australia, as we know, the average income for Australian writers is something like $13,000 a year. So it is a huge achievement to write these, the kinds of works that Mireille does, but also, you know, make a living from it. It's very, very hard to do. And I think that's because she has got this very unique gift. It's a great honour for me today to be interviewing Mireille. I found her latest book absolutely wonderful. It's, you know, very beautifully written, as she always writes beautifully, but also very thrilling in that sort of the way that she creates suspense and withholds information. So it does read like a thriller. It's very, very compulsive reading. And I also think it's appropriate today too that we're speaking about her first piece of non-fiction, because it's a memoir. It's called Reckless, because it fits so beautifully with the overall theme of the festival this year, which is kind of creativity and wild abandon. Mireille will tell you a bit, for those of you who haven't actually read the book, what its genesis were, and you'll see exactly how reckless and what she means by wild abandon when you hear the story. It seems to me that Merrill's imagination has taken her to many places. So I think it's terrific that we're speaking about that in relation to Reckless and the general themes of the audience. So Merrill and I thought we would start this off by her giving you a small reading from the book. Yeah. And it's short, it'll be about 5 minutes or so.
Yeah, probably less than that. Okay, it's from the first chapter, so you don't really need any context there. And the first chapter is called Wandering Eye. Stay inside the fence. Don't play on the road. Don't get into cars with strange men. The world was a dangerous, fearsome place full of dangerous, fearsome people. And now look what was happening. My mother was not only taking me into the world, but leaving me there. Instead of abandoning me in a forest like Hansel and Gretel's parents, she was leaving me at a hospital, St Vincent's in Darlinghurst, a notorious part of Sydney back then. I needed an operation to correct my wandering eye. It wouldn't hurt, Mum assured me. I wouldn't even feel it because the doctors would put me to sleep. Put to sleep. That's what the vet did to the cat next door. We never saw Smokey again. Mum gave me one more big hug and kiss before handing me over. Be a brave girl, she said. It did not occur to me that a mother leaving her 3-year-old daughter might be the one who needed to be brave. The hospital was as grand as a fairy tale palace. I stood on the balustrade, something Mum would never have allowed, 2 stories up, one hand on the cool, solid majesty of a Roman column, the other doing a regal windscreen wiper wave like young Queen Elizabeth. No doubt I was in the protective custody of a nurse, but it was so exhilarating, so exciting up here looking out at everything that I barely registered her presence. The world was wondrous, not dangerous or fearsome at all. Mum started to walk away, still waving. As she grew smaller and smaller, then disappeared into the shadowy trees on the far side of the park, it felt like I was the one leaving, sailing away on a big ocean liner. Then, carbolic stench of the operating theatre, black mask of oblivion with its cargo of choking chloroform, waking into the perpetual darkness of eyes blinded by bandages. This too was the world outside the fence. In the darkness, I found new parts to myself, new skills. Deprived of sight, I reimagined the world through other senses. I came to recognise the distinctive footfall of different nurses, the swish of nuns' habits along the floor. I saw the world through my fingers, traced the outline of the kangaroo on the 1-penny coin, felt the rough or smooth texture of skin as hands held mine. I smelled the swampiness of barely warm gravy at dinner time, the soft blur of face powder that signalled my mother's daily visit, the sharp Brill Cream sweetness of Dad making one of his rare public appearances. My childhood was punctuated by 3 more operations, humiliating stints of wearing a brown paper eye patch, and visits to the orthoptist, a word I loved, a word with double chins and a serious manner. But the deviant eye always looked elsewhere, was never brought into alignment with the good eye. 15 years later, I had grown past childhood, but the condition still persisted. A new specialist determined the problem lay not with the eye itself, but the neural pathway to the brain. 2 eyes, 2 images. Normally the brain superimposes one image on the other. Mine didn't. I had double vision, diplopia, and I lacked binocular vision. The ghost image from the wandering eye hovered like a transparency. Perhaps another operation. It won't correct the condition, but would make the eyes appear to be more in alignment. That was my last visit to the eye clinic. I'd had enough of people trying to correct me and bring me into alignment. I was determined to follow the wandering eye that always looked elsewhere and see where it took me. Go outside the fence, play on the road, get into cars with strange men.
What a cracker of an opening. Isn't that fantastic? And for more of that, read the rest of it. We're going to start talking about your early life, and I don't know whether you think I'm being overly dramatic or overly writerly to say, in that experience, you're talking about double vision, which is what a lot of writers have. They look at the external and they look at the, you know, what's really going, the surface and what's going beneath the surface. And your notion of learning the world through your senses, it seems to me that for a child to experience those things so early must have something to do with your genesis as a writer.
Well, I didn't have any early ambitions to be a writer at all. I always wanted to be a teacher, which is what I did do. And writing came when I was travelling and I was kind of doodling. You don't really think when you're having the early experiences, oh, I'm going to, you know, stash this away for later. But I think it probably had definitely that double vision, the ability and the vision in both eyes is slightly different. So I know when I'm looking at something, it's never objective. Is it really that pink? Or no, when I look at the other eye, it's a little bit bluer. So I know that, you know, that reality is a shifting concept. Also, the ability for us to hold two visions of the one thing in our head, you know, especially if they're contradictory images. But the other thing, and I actually, when I was reading it, I thought about this question that the sensory experience. And as a writer, I very much want to give the reader a sensory experience and not just with the eyes. And I realised I'm looking now in retrospect back to that little 3-year-old girl and then the 5-year-old girl and the 8 and 10-year-old girl who had the eyes bandaged, how you make sense of the world, you kind of construct the world through other senses as well. And nowhere probably was that more obvious in my writing. I mean, I'm always keen on detail. I always want to give the sights and the sounds and to give the reader that sensate experience. But Lambs of God was the one that I tried to bring smell into it. And, you know, there's so little vocabulary for smell. There's floral and astringent and there's like about 5 words that particularly pertain to perfume smells. But there's not the vocabulary, so you have to kind of do that same switchover that I was doing as a child to describe a smell in terms of an oral or a visual image.
Well, do you remember that nun who could sense when people were evil, they were approached, she could smell evil?
Yes,
you know, and I thought that was a wonderful it's a metaphor, but it's also, you know, a heightened sense of smell. So that's an example of that one nun. I do remember that.
It is, and she had an eye problem. And I think anybody that has a problem with one faculty develops more acuity in the others.
Yes.
And so, yeah, because she couldn't see, and she could smell a man approaching the island. And he smelled like pear, vinegar, leather, all kinds of amalgamation of things.
But I love that she could smell the approach of a man. It was a wonderful, wonderful. Just to keep to your early life for the moment, you write very beautifully about your parents, and it's also something that we only learn in retrospect, how we developed as writers and how one becomes a writer. But the mother and the father roles are incredibly important, as they are to everybody, writer or non-writer. But in this instance, you got words from your dad, who was largely silent behind a paper. Mm. He was one of those men of his generation who wasn't a very hands-on father, you might say. Yeah. But your mother was a bookbinder. And I'll just read out this amazing passage early on. Again, she's still in the early days of the book and of her life, actual life. She writes, "From my father, I inherited words. From my mother, books and stories. My mother was a bookbinder. Sometimes she worked at home, sewing copies of law journals together on a frame that resembled a weaving loom, then turning them into a volume with a leather-bound cover. The words on those pages, I assumed, were an integral part of the paper, like the grain in wood. It did occur to me that someone had written them, that there was an author. My mother also sewed blank pages together to make books, the notebook for my father's word museum, and later cloth-bound foolscap notebooks in which I wrote the first drafts of novels. Mum told us stories." I mean, how extraordinary that you could be bequeathed that gift of, you know, the sort of the image of the mother weaving a book in front of you and a father who from whom you inherited your love of woods. Can you tell us a bit more about their role in that way?
Yeah, Dad had a book that my mother made, and he had little letters of the alphabet, tiny little markers that he'd pasted along the side.
That's amazing.
And he was a great crossword fanatic, and he would collect rare and unusual words as if he was doing lapidary, and he would put them into the book. And sometimes in a good mood, and you never knew when that was going to be or when it might change, my father had been one of the rats of Tobruk, and I think every child of my generation grew up with a traumatised soldier in their house. He would sometimes share that, and he would say, as I say in the book, he would say, "Do you know what Lynn means?" And I'd say, "No, Dad, what is it?" And he'd say, "Waterfall." And Riant, "No, Dad, what is it? It means smile or laughter or whatever." I mean, a lot of it was the fact that he was sharing it with me, and this was his kind of way of communicating. I also understood that words were extremely powerful. I remember when my dad's sister, my favourite Auntie Marge, when I was about five, I heard my grandmother say to my mother, "Marge is getting a divorce." And she'd said this word divorce as if she said it out aloud, something would explode or, you know, it would ignite fires. And I heard that sort of power in that word. And so afterwards, I went outside and sat on my grandmother's front steps and told the hydrangeas that Marge was getting a divorce. And I'm sure they shivered.
That's fabulous. I mean, what a gift. It really is. It's remarkable. But you also, can you tell us a bit about your life? Because they didn't have post-secondary education, your parents. Your dad's job wasn't to do with words, was it?
Not at all. I mean, it was always very vague. It was nothing. You know, both my parents left school when they were 13 or 14. I think Dad's first job was a shoe salesman at Mark Foy's in Sydney. And then he was just a clerk. He never talked about the work. I think at one point when credit unions came into Australia, he was one of the people who volunteered to set up a credit union there. And so that was probably the height of his career, and that company merged at some point, and he lost his job in his 50s, and after talking about dole bludgers all his life, he had to go on the dole at that late age and swallow his pride, and he ended up getting a job as a storeman in a hospital, and that was his last job before he retired.
And your mother didn't have further education?
No, she sewed.
Was that something that did she go to a college to learn that, or was it self-taught?
It was self-taught. The sewing, you know, she had the sewing gene, which unfortunately I never inherited. And I remember her once saying to a friend of mine, "I don't know how Morel survives without a sewing machine." So it was very important. And I think that when she left school, she got a job at William Brooks, which made stationery things like that. And she was proofreading telephone books and stuff like that, but she developed into the bookbinder. She did have sewing skills.
Okay. Yeah. And just as an aside, can you your beautiful name, how did that's Marjorie for your aunt.
Yes. And Elsie for my grandmother. Right, okay. So, and it's spelled M-A-R-E-1-L-E. You know, I was very pleased to know the origin of the word, but the name, but, you know, it has given me a lifetime of difficulty in pronunciation and spelling.
We'll talk about reckless now. We're going from, you know, your sedate childhood, protected childhood,
yeah,
and also possibly an overly protected one because of your issues with your eyes. Presumably your mother and father would have been very concerned about that, and possibly you were more protected than other children, possibly. You went from that to very much leaping the fence and having a completely different life to your parents. We will learn a bit about the background to Reckless as Morel talks about it. Memoir is a big departure for her, and I'm just interested, it's her first work of non-fiction, and she's never written a memoir before. Everything else has been fiction. So I'm interested in how you would describe the book. You know, is it... It's partly true crime. It's obviously memoir. But there's also fictionalised, recreated elements in it. Why don't you tell us how you see the book?
Well, I suppose you mean going into the crime story.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's basically my 30-odd year friendship with a very unusual man who one of the many things he did was hijack a plane, and he was also involved in this bank heist that I write about in the book. It's also underpinned, and we'll talk about this later, I suppose, by a deep grief that I had when I was a younger woman that went on for a number of years really get over that, if you ever really get over it. I think, and there are a number of strands to the book which we'll probably get onto as well, it's basically my friendship with this unusual man. I was very concerned about it telling the truth, of being authentic with this, because this was memoir, not based on real life, it was real life. Mm. And I couldn't do the same flights of imagination that I did with Lambs of God or even the Claudia Valentine books, even though there's a real place, a real world setting for the Claudia Valentine books, it's in Sydney. But what I've tried to do, and I gathered as much material as I could about this bank heist that Jean was involved in. Jean Kay was the name of my French friend. And some of that dialogue is reproduced exactly as right. It was. But what I've done is try and set it up in a way that the reader understands this was the research and now I'm going into their minds. Mm. Mm. And I hope that because then I'm showing you the truth.
Yes.
Of how a book's constructed too, in a way.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And we will talk about that later. But can you just tell everyone how you actually came to meet him first? This is what I mean about the recklessness. You know, people say, I've written a book about going to live in Greece with my mother, who was 85, and everyone thinks that's pretty reckless. But wait till you hear this story. I was thinking that pales in comparison with what you did. So
I might talk about the cause of grief. Let's start with that. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, people change their lives. I mean, it's interesting because this is also a memoir of grief. Arguably, you were compelled to make such a radical life change because she did experience such trauma and grief. And in fact, the embezzler and the person that Mireille connected with had also suffered a grief. His mother had died when he was a very young child. And there's also another person in the book whose wife drowned in a bathtub, and he was also incredibly affected by that. So that is the underpinning throughout the whole book. So we can start with that. That is a very important.
I suppose it shows you the illogical, crazy rationale for behaving recklessly. Yeah. My young life partner, my first love, Tony, was killed in a car accident in his late 20s. And I'm sure that everybody who's ever experienced any grief knows how intense that first time is. I was like a zombie. I was literally beside myself. It felt like my spirit had been knocked out of my body. So that image of two double vision, it felt that I was completely out of kilter, out of alignment. And when the first anniversary came around, of course, that was the very worst time in many ways because the same plants were in flower, it happened on a Friday, the 13th of January. It was, you know, midsummer, and the heat and all of that was all the same. And so those sensate reminders were back. I felt like I had come to, it was like a spinning top that had finally stopped and said, you have to do something now. You can't keep living in this zombie-like state between life and death. And it was not something I was thinking with my brain. It came from a much more profound survival place. And so I decided to live, but not just to keep existing, but to live a full life, to live it fully, you know, grab it by both hands. And I had no idea what I was going to do. I did learn Tai Chi and I bought a crate of champagne and did all this kind of stuff. And then I went on what I thought was going to be a two-week holiday to Cairns with a friend and stayed away for 4 years. We hitched a ride on... My friend and I hitched a ride on a boat from Cairns to Darwin, and that skipper turned out to be Captain Bligh, so we got off and we looked for another boat. And thinking this skipper is going to have to be a really good person to compensate for the bad one. And he was, but he did end up being a hijacker. I mean, he'd done that beforehand and he'd been tried and everything.
But you'd had no seafaring experience.
No.
And, you know, you were sailing from Darwin to...
Yeah.
To where?
Well, the original plan was to go from Darwin to Sri Lanka. But we ran into...
I would never get on a boat to go from Darwin to Sri Lanka in a million years.
There's nothing in between. You know, there's Christmas Island and that's it. Yeah. You are really... You can't get off if you need to.
Yeah.
And then somewhere off Ashmore Reef, which is not far from Darwin, we ran... We met up with an Indonesian fishing boat and they were running short of water and they wanted... some water, you know, this is all in sign language. So we were a little bit wary because we'd been told all the time about pirates. They could be pirates. And that was the first time I really understood there was a rifle on board because Jean got this rifle out and stuck it behind the door. And I thought, what do you need a rifle for at sea? You know, you're not shooting fish, you're catching with a line. So that sort of was a little hook of curiosity about who he really was. Anyway, so we gave them a jerry can full of water, threw it over on a rope, and they untied it and, you know, got the rope back. And that made us short of water, so we had to then go and do an emergency landing in Bali and go around and tell everybody our story. And they gave us 5 days shore leave, and then they said, but you can't sail in Indonesian waters after this and you must leave. And Jean was not then keen. I think the boat had started to break up even by that stage. He was not keen to go out in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And we trusted him. You know, he was the experienced skipper. There was another experienced crew member, but the other three of us weren't. And so we decided to hug the coast in case we needed to land somewhere. There were quite a lot of remote islands and unnamed islands along that archipelago. And so we set sail for Singapore, and that's where we ended up. We did eventually make it to Sri Lanka. I got a plane from Singapore to Colombo, and one other crew member stayed on. The rest of us had had enough by that time and sailed the boat from Singapore to Sri Lanka. So the boat did end up in Sri Lanka.
Jean, just to talk about Jean for a moment, Mireille speaks French. Part of her degree was in French, and Jean was French, but she also had a sort of romantic idea from childhood of what your favourite television show was.
Yeah, Adventures in Paradise. I don't know if anybody knows that. La, da, da,
da, da, da, da. Yeah,
still hear it. I can still hear it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, and you know, when every other kids of my age had, you know, pin-ups of the Beatles, of John Paul, Ringo, or all of them. I had Gardner McKay. That was the actor's name, and his character's name was Adam Troy. You know, that was enough, me person being sensitive to words. But he was also sort of drop-dead handsome, and I had the picture of him was at the helm, bare-chested, with a pipe in his mouth. And I thought, I didn't know if I wanted... You know, I was still a child, so I wasn't sure what my attraction... I think it was the life, because I'd been, you know, brought up stay indoors, this is the only place you're safe, and that was not like that at all. You know, there was that appeal. So when I saw Jean, he was also bare-chested, smoking a cigarette in the cockpit of his boat, and it brought back these memories. And the inside of the boat, which was called O-Cat, the catamaran... It looked like how I imagine Adam Troy's, the interior of his boat was as well.
So you write when you first met him, I can't quite pinpoint what it was between Jean and me, but it was all there in the first moment, some elemental empathy. We held each other's gaze, not as tall, dark and handsome as Adam Troy, but... Ah, the same allure of travel to exotic places. Adventure with a capital A. So your knowledge of Jean, you didn't know that you had some suspicion that, look, you've seen the gun.
Oh, not at this stage.
You go on.
Yeah, yeah.
When do you start putting two and two together? Was there any? I mean, it wasn't only the gun, was it? There was a book.
No, yeah, the book, that was important. That was the book was the first thing, probably. Jean was a writer, and that was another plus. Wow, a writer! You know what are the chances? And I was a beginner writer then too. I just got my first Australia Council grant. And, you know, I have acquitted the grant. I didn't just merely go off and do these adventures. I did write the book. It was a collection of short stories. And I noticed the name in Jean's passport, because I had gone around with him in Darwin to do all the ship's clearance and departure papers. His name in the passport was Jean de Rayet. And I recognised a photo of him on one of the books on the shelf. You know, it was exactly looked like him, an author photo. But the name was Jean Kay. So that night when we were changing shift, we were just the two of us out on the deck, I mentioned this, and I said, do you write under a pseudonym? And, you know, he just let it sit for a couple of seconds and he said, no, I travel under a pseudonym. And I thought, oh, okay. And then he started to tell me a little bit about his background. Still not the hijack at this point. He'd said that he'd been in the army, in the French army, when he was young, and then became a soldier of fortune, you know, in Africa. And that he actually told me he'd been given the job to destabilise the Lebanese government, and he just took the money and ran. So, you know, he bought the boat and went off. And he said, war is an absurdity. He'd had enough of that life. Of course, that wasn't the real reason he was on the run. I wouldn't find that out till 30 years later.
So we'll get to that. You've had this initial experience. You kept in touch with him for pre-email, pre-internet. Hard letter
handwritten
letters to each other. You in the meanwhile had started your life as a writer, gone on to publish books. You met again where? At what point did you meet again?
Yeah, well, we fell out of contact for about 10 years of that period.
Okay.
Yes, 7 or 8 or so. And then in the digital age, he must have Googled me because he sent an email to my publishers. I remember the publicist forwarding the email and saying, he sounds a bit weird, we can deal with it if you like. I thought, you've no idea. So I was still a little bit wary. I mean, the voyage ended in near shipwreck. And, you know, I did not want to go on a boat trip with him ever again in my whole life. And I was coming to Europe. I was, among other things, I was doing a reading at a soiree at a famous bookshop in Paris called Shakespeare and Company. I did prevaricate, but eventually I wrote to him and said, look, I'm coming to France. Would you like to meet up for lunch somewhere? And he said, lunch? Nonsense. I'll pick you up wherever you are and bring you to my place and we can stay there a few days and then I'll take you to my new boat.
And we can go on a trip.
Yeah, we'll go on another trip. Yeah. Sri Lanka.
So what year are we talking about then?
Oh, sorry.
How many years between...
Yeah, the boat trip ended in the early 80s. I was on the boat for about 3 months altogether. Early 80s, like 1980. And then it was probably 2009. That I went back to Paris.
Right.
It was a long time. We've been in contact since the sea voyage. And then I went to France and caught up with him for the first time again in 2009. So it's, what is that, 30 years later?
So that must have been a very odd experience to see him again after all those years. Had you known anything about him in the meantime? Like, you know, he could Google you, but had you Googled him?
No, I hadn't.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, I knew he was a hijacker. He had explained
that. How did you know that? Oh, he'd explained...
So
oh, he, that's right.
Sorry, I'm going a bit
that's
back
right,
and forwards,
right.
A bit like the book, in fact.
Yes.
The name Jean Kay on the book cover meant nothing to me, But to the French crew member, she had seen it too.
That's
and
right.
She said to me, I think that guy, there's a really famous French hijacker, I think it's him. And so instead of the whispering behind hands, he then gathered us all together, told us the story that he'd hijacked this plane in 1971, a date in December 1971, to get medical supplies for Bangladeshi refugees. That was at the height of the Bangladeshi Liberation War, and he'd hijacked a Pakistan Airlines plane. That was the enemy, was Pakistan. He went to court for it. He held that the plane was held up on the tarmac for about 7 hours, but eventually, and they delivered one lot of medication, and he was waiting for the rest, and then, you know, police dressed in airport security came on and stormed the plane. He went to court. Actually, he spent about 8 months on remand because the French bureaucracy, being what it was, they couldn't decide which department, which local division to department to try him in, because the nose of the plane was in one local division and the tail was in the other. So meanwhile, he's in jail, which is where he started to write about his own adventures. But some a very well-known French writer, André Malraux, who was also had been the Minister for Culture and other things, spoke on Jean's behalf and said, this man has saved 600,000 lives. I mean, eventually the Red Cross did send the medication to Bangladesh, so the hijack wasn't in vain.
So that is a really curly moral dilemma, isn't it? Because obviously if you're on the plane for 7 hours on the tarmac being held up by, they thought he had a fake gun, it wasn't an actual gun.
Yeah.
Or you've got a relative who's on that plane, you're not going to have much sympathy.
Yeah.
It's a questionable thing because, you know, that, and this was the era of that generation who is anti-war, even though he was a mercenary, he was also, you know, the peace-love generation and acts of selflessness and that sort of heroic acts of selflessness and on behalf of other people. But still, as many terrorists would argue, it's worth sacrificing. It's the ultimate philosophical question. Mm. You know, do you sacrifice the few for the many?
Yeah.
Where do you stand on that? I mean, well, I know that you wrestle
know.
With it, that. It, in
again,
the book.
This is, you know, looking at this same person with two different points of view. Just pertaining to the hijack itself, there was a Bangladeshi film made about it in English in, I think it was released in 2022, so fairly recently. And the filmmaker there took pains to specify that Jean never, ever pointed the gun at the passengers in the plane. He also let off some elderly passengers and a man with a little boy. So, you know, he had that kind of, you know, the hijacker with a big heart. But the thing was, finding that out when Jean told us, and I'd often thought about that, you know, because my mother had always warned me against hitchhiking, which I ignored, of course. She said, you don't know who you're getting in the car with. It could be a murderer. And she didn't say anything about getting on boats with hijackers. So you ask yourself that question, I think. What if I have a friend and the friend has a big secret? What's going to happen to the friendship? And is there a line that you draw in the sand and it's non-negotiable? Mm. I mean, for me, it would be a paedophile. I don't think I could maintain the friendship in that way. I'd never thought of a hijacker, what that would do. But he had, you know, one, he had done it. Well, first of all, I find this out in the middle of the ocean, so there's nowhere you can run. You've got to deal with the situation there.
Yeah.
The fact that he'd done it for humanitarian reasons mitigated a little bit. But by then we'd bonded. I mean, the whole crew had bonded with each other and with him. We'd played chess with him and Scrabble and eaten meals and, you know, had drinks with him. And to find this, you had to accommodate this other view of him then.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very, very interesting question, and she does grapple with it at length in the book too. And, of course, he saw himself as a sort of crusader of lost causes. Yeah. He liked to see himself as a champion of the people in many ways. And he was, in fact, well, André Malraux saw him as that, and many other people did too. How did you feel your... through the writing of the book, I suppose, but also with your relationship with him over that period, did it change? Like, when you started to write the book, did your perception of him change again? I mean, or as you just said, were you prepared to take the contradictions of that person?
Well, I was able to accommodate the hijack.
Right, okay.
So when I went back to France in 2009... Mm. That was then in the past. And he hadn't revealed much else about himself on the boat. He was on the run, so, you know, it wasn't in his interest to do more than he absolutely had to do. When we went to his place, which was a charming little water mill in the French countryside, he said he made some reference to that he'd been involved in this bank heist. Boing.
And you hadn't heard anything about the bank heist.
Didn't know anything about that at the time. And he said, in fact, you were part of it. And I said, what do you mean I was part of it? He said, well, you were part of my life on the run. And I said, but you told me you were on the run from this, you know, doing this Lebanese job that you didn't do. War was an absurdity. And he said, well, I had to say something if I told you the criminal thing, well, endanger himself and, you know, you would have been an accessory as well. But I think it was mainly for his own self-preservation. And so he told me this story that he and a friend and their two girlfriends, his friend was... a high-profile accountant for an aeronautical magnate, Dassault, probably one of the richest and most influential men in France. And the accountant had power of signature. He could sign checks on his behalf. So the two of them decided to, that Hervé Duvater, that's the accountant's name, go into the bank and sign the check for 8 million francs, which was about $10 million in today's money. He had done this kind of thing before, but on a much lower scale, because this was slush fund money. Dassault needed money for bribes for politicians and to get contracts and all of this hush money, all of this other stuff. So there was a slush fund, and this is what Hervé was accustomed to doing.
So he was relying on that as a sort of form of blackmail, that the guy wouldn't squeal because...
Yeah, that's right. He'd compiled a dossier of all these illegal accountancy things that he'd been involved with. So that's what happened. And Jean was organising the getaway plan, which involved hire cars and what have you. It was the perfect plan that went wrong. Sorry, I don't know if I'm going circling around.
No, I'm just for everybody to... This was after Morel met him again. She learned all about the second crime. It was that really that... Then you started to research that when you got back to Australia, but I don't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, that's right. Jean had said, I'm working on this... You know, I'm working on writing this about this, you know, thing that I was involved in all those years ago. So I was absolutely intrigued by it because I am, you know, I'm a crime writer, and to meet a real-life criminal, apart from the hijacking, a bank job, it was for good reasons, you know, they were robbing.
What were they going to do with the 8 million?
Sorry?
What were they going to do with the 8 million?
Oh, well, they were going to throw it from the Eiffel Tower. That didn't happen.
And they were going to donate some to humanitarian...
Yes, Jean was going to... He'd been involved with the phalangists in Lebanon. He was going to, donate to his good causes. So it all looked fine. Later he would say the girls were the ones who really thought, you know, you rob the rich to give the poor, we're the poor, so we'll keep the money. So I was absolutely intrigued by this crime, and when I came back I was still thinking about it, and I wrote and asked Jean how he was going. And he said, well, I'm having some difficulties with it. I can't be the judge, the writer and the protagonist of it. Would you like to do it? And I thought, oh, my God, this is a cordon bleu plot already worked out. I said in the first place, he said, come to my place. I've got all these newspaper clippings here. I can tell you anything you need. I'll pay for your fare. I mean, this was gold. You know, had I been a younger writer, I might have gone, yeah, I'll be doing that. But at that stage too, I was a little bit wary of him. I wasn't going to rush into this. But more than that, at that time, my parents both went into aged care.
Right.
And I thought, I can't be away. Something could happen at any moment. So we made a compromise that I would start to write the book at home in Australia, which I started to do. Jean sent me this kilo and a half of newspaper clippings all about the case. And it wasn't right because that sensate quality was missing. I needed to go back. Well, I couldn't go back to the time, but I could go back to the place. I could go back to Paris.
So did he ask you to write it as true crime or like a faction,
yeah,
non-fiction?
Absolutely.
Okay.
To write it as it actually happened.
Okay.
Real crime, which is true crime, which is what he was going to do.
Right.
And so by that time, my parents were a bit more stable and I thought, you know, I'm missing this sensate dimension. But the other thing too was, my parent, you know, my first adventure was spurred by my partner's death. This one, the decision to go and travel again, to go back to France and find this out, by the fact that my parents were approaching this, was another visceral reminder, how much time did I have left?
Mm.
You know, would I ever get to France again? So I discussed it with my parents and my mother, who had dementia by that stage, although she could remember our names and different things. She said, oh, yes, you know, go and enjoy yourself. Don't stay at home, which had been the contrary to the message I'd had from all her life. So I went back then and researched it.
And so there was quite a long period of researching and writing before the actual publication of the book.
Yeah.
Many, many years, in fact. So what happened to propel you to actually start writing?
Well, that was another thing. I mean, in the first place, it was going to be a focus on the true crime. I mean, I was in it a little bit because I'd gone to see the accountant's lawyer and his daughter, and I got information that wasn't anywhere else available. So I had to say how I got it, but it wasn't really working in that form. And then something dramatic happened. My present partner, got seriously ill, and so all that just had to, you know, be put aside. I didn't want to put myself more in the book than was already there because I'm quite a private person, despite I'm sitting up here, I know I'm talking about my life in front of strangers. You're not all strangers.
Mm-hmm.
So when my partner had recovered, and this was a period of a few years, it made me again, and again this brush with death made me think about how much time have I got left? What do I want to leave behind? This story will die with me.
Mm.
And so instead of then being reluctant to put myself on the page, I felt a great urgency to do so. And I mean, I didn't want to put those soft, squishy bits about how terrible I felt in the grief and all of that and the feelings of doubt that I had about Jean as I started to do the research and progressed with that. I think I've often found through my life, I suppose it could become my mantra, fortune favours the brave. If you take the step, there will be a good result from it.
I think, you know, we spoke before when we were talking about what we're going to talk about today, you know, the differences between memoir and fiction, and we agreed that both of them seek to represent a kind of truth different ways. And it is, you said it was the writer's moral obligation and responsibility to tell the truth, but whose truth? And you said at some point you realised that you were the teller of the story and you actually wrote, I'm the one who has to decide what to reveal and what to withhold. This is the biographer's betrayal of their subject, taking the story outside of their subject's control.
Yeah.
So How did you find the voice to write this story? Because there's a you, Morel, the person, and then there's the authorial voice, and somehow you seem to have got that voice right. Was it Jean did die, and it opens. I don't think I'm telling anything outside of the. It's in the very beginning of the book. That seemed to be free you in some way.
Yeah.
I don't know when you found that voice. I mean, how did you go about?
I mean, I know I was at an Adelaide festival one year and I heard a biographer, George Bernard Shaw's biographer, say the best subject is someone who's alive while you're doing the research and dies shortly before publication.
Yeah.
So, look, I don't know. I can't say, you know, the hypothetical if Jean hadn't died before I finished the book. But, you know, I think my feelings of obligation to tell the truth would have overrode my feelings of friendship for him as a writer. I mean, there was Morel, the friend of Jean, and I'm thinking he might not like this, but I've got this obligation to tell the truth. Now, in terms of the voice, that was a problem to start with. I'm thinking, how do I tell this story? Because all my other books had been fiction. Mm. I mean, I'd had the voice of a tough female private eye, the voice of, you know, sequestered nuns, Mrs. Cook, Captain Cook's wife, Japanese pearl divers, so all kinds of different voices. And the voice in the book, the narrator's voice, because I told it in the first person, is not the voice I'm speaking now, you know, it's a more casual voice. So what I did, I mean, when I was going back through my papers and research for the book, I was coming across handwritten letters that I'd received from people, and even some from me. I mean, Tony had kept some of my letters, so I had what I had written too. And I looked at the tone of those letters to one trusted friend, and what it is, and often those friends were other writers, and you do reveal all, but it's constructed in a way as well. And I think that's what I was trying to get, a reveal all, but it's crafted, and that I'm telling a trusted friend, one reader. I mean, I've never been aware of the readers in fiction. My obligation was to the characters and tell their story as best I could. But this, for the first time, I felt the obligation to the reader. Imagining I was writing for a reader, I found my way to that voice. And it's a kind of signature as well. I've stepped from behind the curtain of fiction to come out and say, this is what happened in my life.
We're getting to the end. I've got many, many more questions, but I just wanted to ask, you describe yourself in the book as a dedicated introvert, as well as a girl who wanted to see how close to the edge you could go. And you write that it took you years to make your way to this is a beautiful phrase, the small, quiet oscillations at the centre. So I guess my question is for you, a more general question. Are you happy at the moment to give up the idea of elsewhere and to dwell in the centre? I mean, how do you feel, I suppose, as a writerly self and as a Morel living in this area now, reliving that story, has that reignited the sense of adventure that do you miss it, or are you completely accepting and thankful for the life at the centre now?
I still think I can do it any time I like. I mean, even in 2011, which when I was no longer my younger self, I did go to Brazil to follow the trail of this story. You know, the story was impelling me to go wherever it would. But the oscillations, I think I was doing that when I said I didn't know how to live. I just needed to live fully and wasn't sure how to do it. Swinging from edge to edge, like to going to the extremes, I think I was trying to find something that I could feel that wasn't grief. And I realised that You've lost your groundedness. I needed to be earthed, and in this place, I feel earthed.
Well, I think that's a wonderful place to stop. And thank you so much to Morel for sharing so much of her life. And rush out and buy this book. She'll be up there. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.